thought I would give a little different type of sermon this afternoon. We don't talk about biographies all that much about other people, but the sermon this afternoon is about the biography of a particular individual in the Bible that isn't talked about all that much. I used to watch on TV the Biography Channel. It was very, very interesting to see videos of the biography of certain individuals, famous people, not so famous people, and it was quite interesting and also educational at times to listen to or read the biographies of individuals. Biography means the lives of people in written form or in the video form, as we do think about today. Biographies give us an insight into the human element of human beings, and sometimes in listening to a biography, you get the good and the bad, and it can be a very, very powerful element in our own life because we learn from reading or watching the lives of other people. And we also, as we watch it, seeming like we always do, we relate to what they're saying as to how it relates to us. Could I have done that? Or would I have wanted to do that? Or how in the world did they do that? I don't think I could have done it that way. So today I'd like to cover a biography, this time that of a woman, and a lady she was. She was apparently a very attractive and very wealthy individual, a married lady. And how old she was, I don't know, but she wasn't an old, old lady. She was apparently a fairly young lady, as I said, very attractive and fairly wealthy. Unfortunately, she didn't have a very good marriage. Not a good marriage at all. And even though her husband was wealthy, he didn't have a very good attitude toward life, and he didn't have a very good personality. But she, and I don't know where she got all of this, but the lady had great wisdom. She was very diplomatic, and she was able to use tact when it was needed. She also, at times, when called for, had what I would call a great deal of audacity, not in a wrong way, but when she needed to speak out, she actually did. She actually stopped a massacre all by herself of 400 soldiers. So in several ways, this lady is a really great example. How many of you know who I'm talking about? Good. Very good. Very, very good. Abigail. Abigail, the wife of Nabal. Nabal. The story isn't long, but it has an awful lot of drama and life. Her life story would make a really good Hollywood movie if they would do that and do it the way it actually happened, not add the Hollywood's part to it. Abigail's life is intertwined with that of King David, or at that time he wasn't King David, he was to be the king, but David ben Jesse, future king of Israel, and their lives intertwined while David was fleeing for his life from the real king, King Saul. The story starts about 1000 B.C., and the story before what we're going to see to begin with was that Saul, king of Israel, had been rejected because he didn't do it God's way, and God had selected King David, and Saul was very jealous of him and tried to kill him several times. And so David was fleeing for his life. So with that in mind, let's go to 1 Samuel 24, and we'll get a little bit of background and information about David's situation. In 1 Samuel 24, and we will start in verse 1. Very nice place to start. 1 Samuel 24. 24 and verse 1. Now it happened, and that's the way a lot of things are, things happen. And it says, now it happened when Saul had returned from following the Philistines, that it was told him, saying, take note, You're looking for him? You want to kill him? Well, listen, David's in the wilderness of En-Gedi. En-Gedi was west central bank of the Dead Sea, and it was north of Masada. And he had gone to that place to try to get away from Saul to keep from being killed or murdered, slaughtered. So, verse 2, it says that Saul took 3,000 chosen men from all of Israel. Now, this shows the great courage that Saul had. David had 400 to 600 men, and Saul chose 3,000 to chase them. Going to make sure that he slaughtered them easily. So he took 3,000 chosen men, not just anybody, but chosen men, and went to seek David and his men on the rocks of the wild goats. Verse 3 says, he came to the sheepfolds by the road where there was a cave. And it's kind of humorous the way God adds a few human incidences into the story. We all understand that if we eat, we have to go to the bathroom. If we drink a lot of water, we have to do other things. And so it says, there was a cave, and Saul went in to attend to his needs. Very polite way of putting it. He had to go to the bathroom. And of course, Saul didn't know it, but David and his men were staying in the backside of the cave. A little humorous. And in verse 4, the men of David said to him, because they knew that he was fleeing for his life from the king, and the king was not an honorable king. He was going to murder David because he was jealous of David and couldn't accept the fact that God had rejected him. The men of David said to David, "This is the day of which the Lord said to you, 'Look, David, I'll deliver your enemy into your hand, that you may do to him as it seems good to you.'" Now that appealed to David because he could have done it. But notice what David said, and I think this is an honorable part of David that is missing in today's world and maybe doesn't have the same strength in our lives as we ought to. David arose and secretly cut off a corner of Saul's robe. So he gave into it just a little. Well, this is just the update coming up to the actual involvement of the biographical individual, Abigail. It happened afterward that David's heart troubled him because he had cut Saul's robe, which to our way of looking today, so he cut Saul's robe. Well, remember, Saul was the king. He was God's chosen, but he had disqualified himself. But still he was the king, and he still had that office. And so David honored the office. He didn't necessarily honor the man, but he did honor the office because God had put the man there to begin with. And you will find he said to his men, "God forbid that I should do this thing to my master." What do you mean, his master? He still honored the king. And Saul was his master in that he was king and David wasn't yet. "To do this thing to my master, the Lord's anointed." God had put his name on Saul and Saul had misused what God had given to him. "I should not do this thing to the Lord's anointed to stretch out my hand against him, seeing he is the anointed of the Lord." So David restrained his servants with these words, and he didn't allow them to rise up against or kill Saul. And Saul finished what he had in mind to do, got up and left, went out of the cave, went on his way. Then you'll find David didn't do what they wanted him to, but he did do something that cut to the core of Saul's guilt. David also arose, went out of the cave, called out to Saul and said, and notice his language to his king, "My lord, the king." And when Saul looked behind him, David stooped with his face to the earth. Now, many of us might not have the thoughtfulness to do that, to actually, as we say, curtsy to the queen or bend to the king. David stooped with his face to the earth and bowed down to the man who was out to kill him. David said to Saul, "Why do you listen to the words of men who say, 'Indeed, David seeks your harm'? Look," he said, "this day your eyes have seen that the Lord delivered you to me, into my hand in the cave, and someone urged me to kill you. But my eye spared you, and I said, 'I'm not going to do that against my Lord. He is the Lord's anointed.' Moreover, my father," and a term of respect and honor here, "moreover," he said, "look, yes, see the corner of your robe in my hand, for in that I cut off the corner, I didn't kill you. And know and see that there is neither evil nor rebellion in my hand, and I've not sinned against you, yet you hunt my life to take it." He was very blunt and very straightforward, but he was not cynical, he was not sarcastic, he was not trying to destroy Saul, because verse 12 shows why he didn't feel that he had to. He said, let the Lord judge between you and me, and let the Lord avenge me of you, but my hand shall not be against you." And then he said in verse 13, "As the proverb of the ancient says, wickedness proceeds from the wicked." This makes sense. If you're a wicked person, usually it will proceed as wickedness. "But my hand shall not be against you. And whom has the king of Israel come out for? Whom do you pursue? A dead dog or a flea? You don't need all these 3,000 men to get rid of me. Therefore, let the Lord be judge and judge between you and me, and see and plead my case and deliver me out of your hand." David did not fall prey to the urgings of his men. He could have, humanly speaking, he had a right to do that, but he didn't do it because he factored God into the case, and that this man, evil though he was, trying to kill him though he was God's anointed, and God had not yet totally removed him. But that wasn't far away. In verse 16, when David had finished speaking these words to Saul, Saul said, "Is this your voice, my son David?" And he lifted up his voice and wept. He had ego, but he also had guilt. And there were times when Saul gave in to the guilt and to the feelings that he should have been giving in to long ago, and it got to him, but not for long. Then he said to David, "You're more righteous than I. You've rewarded me with good, whereas I rewarded you with evil." He acknowledged what he had been doing. "And you've shown this day how that you've dealt with well with me. For when the Lord delivered me into your hand, you didn't kill me." He realized he could have been dead. If a man finds his enemy, will he let him get away safely? No, that's not the way war is. "Therefore, may the Lord reward you with good for what you've done to me this day." And then notice what Saul said. "And now I know indeed that you surely shall be king, and that the kingdom of Israel shall be established in your hand." And yet, he didn't give up his quest to kill David. "Therefore, swear now to me by the Lord that you will not cut off my descendants after me." That's important. You know, if it's one thing to die, but it's one thing for your whole clan to be murdered and removed from genealogy. "And also swear that you will not destroy my name from my father's house." Now, David could have said, well, you think I am an idiot? I've got you where I want you. I'm not going to swear that. You deserve what you're getting. So David swore to Saul, And Saul went home. But David and his men went up to the stronghold. Now, even though he swore that he wouldn't do certain things, notice it said David went up to the stronghold, or I think in the old King James, the hold, or the stronghold, or the, you might say, the castle that nobody could get into, the stronghold of En-Gedi. Now, why would he do that when he just promised certain things to Saul? David did not trust Saul. He was courteous to him, but he did not trust him. And we sometimes find that difficult to produce in our lives, to be courteous and yet not trust. David had that capacity. So coming into chapter 25, you will find in verse 1, Samuel died and the Israelites. Now you may be saying, well, where is he going with this sermon? I know we're going to get to Abigail. We are, but we've got a little bit leading up to Abigail. Can you can see how it was that she came into the picture? Samuel died, the Israelites gathered together and lamented for him and buried him in the home of Ramah. David arose and went down to the wilderness of Paran. So he was, he went farther away to get away from Saul. In verse 2, it begins to bring another aspect into the story leading up to the biography, shall we say, of a lady, a lovely lady, Abigail. In verse 2, now there was a man in Maon whose business was in Carmel. The man was very rich. Not only was he wealthy, it said he was very rich. And then it gives us where he got his wealth. He had 3,000 sheep. He had 1,000 goats. He was shearing sheep in Carmel. The man's name, Nabal. And his wife's name, Abigail. Carmel was west of En-Gedi, south of Hebron. So he was in the general area where David had been. He was very great and very wealthy. He had a lot of stock. You know, we talk about we have shares of stock. Well, in those days, they had herds of stock, and that was their wealth. His name was Nabal, which is a root word, and it means to wilt or to be stupid or vile or impious. I don't know why would his parents name him that. We sometimes say you have to be careful what name you give something because it will come to pass. It will be that way. Some of you may remember that poodle dog Delia and I had. We named him Rascal. We never should have done that because a rascal he became till the day he died. I used to have to fight my way to get on my bed to get him out of there so I could go to bed in my own bed because he felt he was dog of the house. Well, anyway, Nabal could mean vile, impious, adult, and he did live up to his name. He lived up to his name, or by being stupid, it led him to become very vile. It says there's one place, maybe it doesn't list it in this, but in the old King James, he was listed as a churl or churlish, which means cruel, grievous, hard-hearted, surly, evil in his doing. So you can find from reading some of these names or words about his name, he didn't appear to be a very converted or congenial individual. He had a lot of money. He wasn't all that courteous to people. In verse 3, it says, the man was harsh and evil in his doings. And then it seems to add a little contradictory. He was at the house of Caleb. Now, Caleb was a famous one who had been faithful to God when Israel went up to search out the land. Caleb was one of those who was faithful and said, no, we have to have faith in God. But apparently, Nabal did not have the nature and character of his forefather. Whatever it was, he didn't have the character and the nature of his forefather. It says in verse 3, after giving his name, the first sentence, it said his name was Nabal, and the name of his wife, Abigail. So finally she comes into the story, the biography, about this lovely lady who was married to a churl. There's nothing given about how they knew each other, how long they'd been married, why she married him, why he married her. It's just that they did marry. She was a lovely woman, a really nice feminine individual. She didn't have a great inferiority complex. She was plain spoken. She could. She challenged 400 soldiers and won the battle. Abigail, she was a woman of good understanding. She was a woman who was beautiful in her appearance. A double whammy. Very good understanding, very beautiful. But he was harsh and evil in his doings. She was a lovely lady, a feminine human being with good understanding, a sound head on her shoulders, and she was very, very attractive. It lists that. How did these two contrasting individuals, male and female, get together? Who knows? People seem to attract at times. I don't know if she was attracted to him. I'm sure he was attracted to her. Maybe it was because he had money. I don't know. It said he was wealthy, and of course, she was wealthy because of being married to him. Who knows? It isn't said how long they had been married. But after the story begins, they weren't married all that long. These things are not mentioned. And it's also not mentioned as to whether or not they had children. They had a house, and I'm sure it was a very, very nice house because they were people of wealth. But it wasn't what you would call a home. Now in the story, you'll find that it begins to switch. Verse 4. When David heard in the wilderness that Nabal was shearing his sheep. So David was fleeing from Saul, and he happened to come into the area of Nabal and Abigail. And, you know, there were 600 with him. 400 were mainly soldiers. I've forgotten the aspect of the other 200. But if you got 600 hungry men in the wilderness, you're going to need some food. And I don't think they had planted a garden. They were looking for food wherever they could get it. And David heard, if he was aware of Nabal before that, it isn't said, but he heard that Nabal was shearing sheep, and I suppose he heard that Nabal also had, 3,000 sheep, something like that. In other words, he had more than he needed in some senses. He heard that Nabal had a big outfit, like the XIT Ranch in the Panhandle of Texas, which spread over 10 counties in the Panhandle of Texas in the 1880s, a few years before that. Nabal was a very wealthy man, a big outfit in his region. He was known for his wealth. So, since the men were hungry, it says in verse 5, that David sent 10 young men. And he said to the young men, go up to Carmel, go to Nabal, and greet him in my name. So that says, or certainly implies, that Nabal should have known who David was and the being that David was, and that he was fleeing from the king who was out to kill him. Greet him in my name. And here's what you're to say to him, to that man who lives in prosperity. Not only was he wealthy, but he was a prosperous man in the sense that he had lots in addition to, as we say, money. say to him, peace be to you, peace to your house, and peace to all that you have. And then continuing what they were to say to Nabal, it says, now I've heard that you have shearers. Your shepherds were with us, and we did not hurt them. Using a little diplomacy, hopefully trying to get him to think, well, I'm not just a wayward man out here trying to find something to eat. We're fleeing for our lives. We didn't take your sheep. We didn't steal anything. We actually helped out. We didn't hurt them. There was nothing missing from them all the while we were in Carmel. Ask your young men. They'll tell you. Therefore, and then he coming to the point, let my young men find favor in your eyes, for we come on a feast day. And notice again he used diplomacy, and he didn't say, I know you have a lot of sheep and I want some. It said, please give whatever comes to your hand to your servants and to your son David. So the young men went to Nabal, and they spoke to Nabal according to all the words in the name of David. And then they waited for the sheep, thinking they would get it. But they didn't know what Nabal meant. Nabal answered David's servant. He said, who's David? Who's this son of Jesse? There are a lot of servants today who break away from each one from his master. So he wasn't very happy to be asked to give something away of what he had. Actually, he put down David, saying, who is he? I'm sure he had heard something about David. I feel kind of sure that he also had heard that David was probably going to be the next king. But he was a churl. Who is he? Who is this individual? And he tried to demean David as much as he can. Now notice verse 11, and this shows some of his attitude. Shall I? Notice the number of times the word I or me or mine are listed in this, which shows an awful lot of self-centeredness. Shall I then take my bread and my water and my meat or food that I have killed for my shearers and give it to men whom I don't know where they come from? Why are they here? So David's young men turned on their heels and went back. They found out that Nabal was not, he was prosperous, but he was not generous, and he was selfish, and he railed on them. So they went back to David, and they told David all that they had been told. Now, in one sense, what David did next shows that he wasn't thinking very well either. David said to his men, every man gird on his sword. He was angry. He was impetuous. He didn't stop to think. It shows David's nature that he was impetuous. And of course he had 600 men in all, 400 to follow him. He had just gotten through telling Saul that God would be the judge of certain things, and yet here he was not waiting for God to be the judge. He was going to take his sword and he was going to wipe out these men as quickly as he could. Gird on your sword. So every man girded on his sword, and David girded on his sword. About 400 men went with David, and 200 stayed to keep the supplies. Now I don't know how many men Nabal had, but David took 400 men to wipe them out. He was pretty angry, hot-headed, impetuous, and he didn't think it through very much. Then Abigail comes back into the story, and it shows she had a more sound head at this particular time. The scene switches again, and Abigail enters the picture very nicely. One of the young men, Nabal's men, told Abigail, so it shows that she had an ability to deal with men, and she was well known by her servants or his servants. The man said to Nabal's wife, "Look, David sent messengers from the wilderness to greet our master, and our master reviled those." But then they said, "You know, there's more to the story. The men were very good to us, and we weren't hurt by them. We didn't miss anything as long as we accompanied them when we were in the fields. They were honorable individuals. They were a wall to us, both by night and day, all the time we were with them keeping the sheep. These were not hustlers. These are not men trying to get something for nothing. They could have taken anything they wanted. They could have killed us. They were honorable men." Then verse 17, "Now, therefore, know and consider what you will do," or "you better do." They gave her some advice. "You best do this, for harm is determined against our master and against all his household. He is such a scoundrel, and one can't even talk to him." They knew that about him, and they knew that's what David was reacting to. They said to Abigail, "You best do something," which showed she had rapport with the men. She had rapport with those men. And you will find that Abigail was a woman of action. Action. She didn't say, "Well, what am I going to do?" She had a plan immediately. 400 men going to wipe out her husband, his men, and who knows what else. Abigail made haste and took. Now notice what she took. Now first of all, she knew she was dealing with an army. And as a woman dealing with men, she had rapport with her men, the men there on their ranch. She knew that an army moves on its stomach. You've heard that before. And she did these things with wisdom. She took 200 loaves of bread. Where did she get all this? She didn't cook it immediately, so she had a big pantry, that's for sure. 200 loaves of bread, 2 skins of wine, 5 sheep already dressed, because she had to be in charge of feeding her men, 5 seahs, and I'm not sure how big that was, of roasted grain, 100 clusters of raisins. You think, "Gag, what are they doing with those?" Well, you know what? If you've been marching for a day, your blood sugar may be a little low, and a little few raisins will put the right sugar in your bloodstream for the right reason and the right way. 200 cakes of figs, and she loaded them on donkeys. It said she was a woman of action. She took a gift, pretty good sized gift, and she just happened to have that in her home. For 600 men, she knew men. She knew that soldiers moved on their stomach and that maybe she could assuage their difficulties. In verse 19, she said to her servants, go on before me. I'm coming after you." But she didn't tell her husband. Now, was she a rebellious woman? No, she was wise as a serpent, harmless as a dove. He was a drunkard. He didn't have common sense. And he was going to be wiped out. Why should she tell him, you're going to be killed? She did not tell her husband, and she took responsibility. You'll see that in a minute. In verse 20, you also see that she could ride a horse, shall we say, or a donkey. So it was, as she rode on the donkey, no other side saddle or straddled the donkey, didn't say, but she rode the donkey. She was a lovely lady, a feminine woman, a good housekeeper, a good wife. She coordinated things. She understood men. And she could ride a donkey. I don't know. Tall as I long as my legs are, I could never ride a donkey. As she rode on the donkey, she went down under cover of the hill. You know, she wasn't going to just ride up there immediately and challenge him. And as she came around the bend, there was David and his men. Was 400 of them, was it? Coming down toward them. And she met them. She didn't turn and run. She met them. 400 soldiers. In verse 21, David had said, surely in vain I've protected all this fellow has in the wilderness, so that nothing was missed of all that belonged to him, and he has repaid me evil for good. And here was David's attitude. He had a mindset. May God do so and more so to the enemies of David if I leave one male of all who belong to him by morning light. I'm going to kill them all. David was a man of blood at times. Notice especially verse 23. When Abigail saw David, she knew who he was. I don't know how much she was aware of him or knew of him or, shall we say, knowledgeable of him. She dismounted quickly from the donkey, fell on her face before David and bowed to the ground. Now, she wasn't worshiping a man. As I said, I feel pretty sure she knew he was going to be the next king. And she was showing deference to someone who could have destroyed everything that her husband and she had. And then it didn't show an inferiority complex woman. It didn't show a codependent. It showed a woman who has a mind of her own, a will of her own, and a woman of good understanding. Then you'll find, beginning in verse 24, a tremendous speech that she gave. I don't think Toastmasters will ever have one equal to this. So she fell at his feet and said, she wasn't trembling, so scared she couldn't talk. She had a mind. She fell at his feet and said, on me, my Lord, on me let this iniquity be. She was willing to take responsibility for all that had happened. And please let your maidservant speak in your ears and hear the words of your maidservant. She didn't say, you idiot, don't you understand what you're doing? Shut up and listen, I've got something I want to say. She was showing diplomacy, she was showing kindness, and she was showing deference. Please let not my Lord regard this scoundrel Nabal. She called her husband a scoundrel. She knew it. Let not my Lord reward this scoundrel Nabal, for as his name is, so is he. Nabal is his name, and folly is with him. But I, your maidservant, did not see the young men of my Lord to whom you sent. Now, therefore, my Lord, or my Lord, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, since the Lord has held you back. So she had a knowledge of God, and she was preaching a very powerful point to David. David was a man of God. He factored God into the picture, but he didn't at this point. He was going to wipe him out. As the Lord lives and as your soul lives, since the Lord has held you back from coming to bloodshed and from avenging yourself. That was us. She hit David right in the face with that those words. From avenging yourself with your own hand, now then let your enemies and those who seek harm for my Lord be as Nabal. And now this present, big present it was. It was a gift that she was giving to him. Because David had asked for food and Nabal wouldn't give it. So she brought it. She brought the very thing that he had asked for. This present which your maidservant has brought to my Lord, let it be given to the young men who follow my Lord. You ask for it, I have brought it. It was catered, and he didn't have to pay a thing for it. And notice that she appealed to God, to a man who looked to God. David would have shown his ignorance if he had not listened to what she said, because he claimed to be a follower of God, and she was saying God's truth very, very clearly. In verse 25, I've already read it, but she said, I didn't see them. In other words, she said, I'm not like my husband. And then she appealed to God, to a man who looked to God. And in verse 27, I have brought this to you for the young men who follow you. Here is what you requested. You asked for food. I have brought food. And then in verse 28, she said, please forgive the trespass of your maidservant, for the Lord will certainly make for my Lord an enduring house. She knew David had a future. Because my Lord fights the battles of the Lord. My Lord meaning David. And evil is not found in you throughout your days. Well, there was to be some evil later, maybe some 20 or so years later. David did some evil things, some pretty bad things. But in this one, it was just emotion, impetuous. She said in verse 29 that she understood why he was fleeing. Yet a man has risen to pursue you and seek your life. But the life of my Lord shall be bound in the bundle of the living with the Lord your God. She said, what she was saying is, God will take care of you. And the lives of your enemies he shall sling out as from the pocket of a sling. David understood that because that's how he killed Goliath. And it shall come to pass when the Lord has done for my Lord according to all the good that he has spoken concerning you and has appointed you ruler over Israel. You don't have to do this, David. You have it. You have a wonderful future. God will make you king. You don't need to be an impetuous slaughterer at this particular time. And then in verse 30 and 31, I read 30, but to read it again, in line with 31. It'll come to pass, when the Lord has done for my Lord according to all the good that he has spoken concerning you, and when he has appointed you ruler of Israel, then verse 31, that this will be no grief to you, nor offensive heart to my Lord, either that you have shed blood without cause, or that my Lord has avenged himself. That was strong language. I don't know if he even knew her. It isn't said that he knew her, and he was taking it right on the chin, and he deserved it. But when the Lord has dealt well with my Lord, then remember your maidservant. She said to David, don't do something you will regret when you are king. How many men have done things in their impetuosity, in their ignorance, in their foolishness, in their machoism, done things that later they regretted, but they couldn't undo it. She helped him not to have that on his conscience. Don't do something you will regret as king. And don't avenge yourself. Those were cutting words, cutting clear through to the heart. But they were diplomatic. She had diplomacy. Her words were not laced with acid. She was not full of sarcasm. She was not full of criticism. She didn't say, "Well, I know what men are like. You're fighting, you're warring, you're killing, and you want sex." She could have cut him in pieces, but she didn't. Because, in truth, many men were like that. And on the surface, it may have appeared that way. One young lady and a donkey and a lot of food, 400 bloodthirsty soldiers, and a leader bent on revenge, full of emotion. She faced them all, and she won the battle. What a lady. You can hear Clint Wood and the good, the bad, and the ugly, and all of that. Clint Eastwood, I'm not sure I called him. But there was the good, the bad, and the ugly all in one place. David had weapons, Abigail had food and sound words. David was impressed, very impressed. In verse 32, David said to Abigail, as I said, I don't know if he ever knew her before, but he was impressed. And she was a young lady. I don't know how he was around. David was around 30. I don't see her as 50, 60, or 70-year-old. And on the other hand, I don't see her as a 15-year-old. Maybe she was 25 or 30 also. It doesn't say, and it's not really that important. But he said to Abigail, "Blessed is the Lord God of Israel who sent you this day to meet me." In other words, God has worked through you. Now, he wasn't going to give her any credit. Typical male. He was not going to give her the credit. "Blessed is your advice, and blessed are you, because you have kept me this day from coming to bloodshed and from avenging myself with my own hand." He acknowledged that. Give him credit there. "For indeed, as the Lord God of Israel lives, who has kept me back from hurting you, unless you had hurried and come to meet me, surely by morning light, no males would have been left to Nabal at all alive." Strong language also. And of course, she knew that. She understood that. He admitted to her what he would have done. And he acknowledged Abigail. And he said in verse 35, "You've made your point. You have made your point." David received from her hand what she had brought him. And he said to her, "Go up in peace to your home. See, I've heeded your voice and I've respected your person." Quite a lot. Then in verse 36, we find that disaster was averted. So back at the ranch, or the big house, Abigail went to Nabal. And there he was, holding a feast in his house like the feast of a king. Because he had money, lots of money. Nabal's heart was merry within him, for he was, now it didn't say he was drunk, it said he was very drunk. I may have mentioned before, as a kid, I grew up not far from the Brazos River in south central Texas, and I remember hearing my relatives talk about a man who lived right on the Brazos River and had a really nice ranch, a big ranch, I believe, raised cattle and horses. But they would talk about Harley Portwood being drunk for a month, and I couldn't fathom any man being drunk for a month as a young kid, but that's the way he was. He was very, very drunk. And that's what it says here about Nabal. He was very drunk. Therefore, she didn't tell him anything, little or much, till morning light. Wouldn't have done any good. She knew her husband. She had diplomacy. She was a wise woman. So it was in the morning when the wine had gone from him, or most of it, shall we say. Anybody that drunk, I think it takes more than just sun up. When the wine had gone from Nabal and his wife had told him these things, that his heart died within him and he became like a stone. You know, you can drink so much and it gets to your body, you're not going to recover from it. Alcohol is awful when misused. About 10 days later, God struck Nabal and he died. It appears kind of like then that Abigail's story was over, but it wasn't. 39. So when David heard that Nabal was dead, he said, "Blessed be the Lord who has pleaded the cause of my reproach from the hand of Nabal, and kept his servant from evil. For the Lord does return the wickedness of Nabal on his own head." And then it just kind of puts it in the story flow. And David sent and proposed, in the New King James, I think the Old King James says took, David sent and proposed to Abigail to take her as his wife. So, knowing David's propensity, I would assume she was a very beautiful young woman. He didn't need her money, but she also, now that her husband was dead, had land, had property, had cattle or sheep, had donkeys. She was a prosperous, wealthy woman. She gave it all up to marry David. Verse 40, when the servants of David had come to Abigail at Carmel, they spoke to her and they said, "David sent us to you. He wants to ask you to become his wife." She arose, bowed her face to the earth and said, "Here is your maidservant. Here is a servant to wash the feet of the servants of my Lord." She was also a humble lady. Now, this doesn't show an inferiority-complex woman who didn't have strength to say four words to by themselves. She was a woman of strength, of courage, of diplomacy, and yet femininity. I've said before, Marilyn Monroe once said, "I don't mind living in a man's world, as long as they'll let me be a woman." Because she knew she had them in the palm of her hand. "Here is your maidservant." So Abigail rose in haste and rode in a donkey, attended by five of her maidens, and she followed the messengers of David and became his wife. Even so, it still doesn't end. In let's go to chapter 27. Verse 1 Samuel 27, verse. This talks about David now after he had married Abigail. He had to flee to Achish, king of Gath, which was over toward the Mediterranean Sea. You will find, it says in chapter 27, verse 1, David said in his heart, "Now shall I shall perish by the hand of Saul." And this talks about in chapter 26 about Saul hearing where he was, and that he now, even though David had sworn to him certain things, and Saul had cried with tears, somewhat, you might say, when he realized David could have killed him and didn't. David did not trust Saul, and with great reason. And you'll find in verse 1, "I shall perish someday by the hand of Saul," David said to himself. "There's nothing better for me than that I should speedily escape to the land of the Philistines, and then Saul will despair of me. To seek me, he will not seek me anymore in any part of Israel. So I'll escape out of his hand." So he arose, took with him his 600 men who were with him. And then it says in verse 3, David dwelt with Achish at Gath, he and his men, each with his household. David with his two wives, Ahinoam the Jezreelite, and Abigail the Carmelitess, Nabal's widow. So, Abigail gave up all that she had, it appears that way. She married David, and now she's having to flee for her life because David's on the run from Saul. Either she loved him or she didn't have any common sense at all, because she had it made apart from David, humanly speaking. She gave up her home and her wealth and also took on another wife with her, the two wives of David, so she wasn't the only woman. I would believe that it was not an easy life, David moving from place to place. And especially you'll find in 1 Samuel 30 and verse 1. 1 Samuel 30 and verse 1. "When David and his men came to Ziklag on the third day, the Amalekites had invaded the south, and Ziklag attacked and burned it with fire. And they took captives the women and those who were there from small to great. They didn't kill anybody, but they carried them away and went their way. So David and his men came to the city, and there it was burned with fire. Their wives, their sons, their daughters had been taken captive." Of course, they assumed their wives and children were all dead. "David and the people who were with him lifted up their voices and wept until they could cry no more. Because both his wives had been taken captive. And he was distressed," in verse 6. "The people wanted to stone him, because the soul of all the people were grieved, every man for his sons and daughters. But David strengthened himself in the Lord his God," talking to God about it. Now let's see, let's come down to verse 18. You'll find certain things happened. And in verse 17, David attacked them from twilight till the evening the next day. Not a man of them escaped except 400 young men who rode on camels and fled. So David recovered all the Amalekites had carried away, and he rescued his two wives. I believe the Amalekites were descendants of Esau, the forefather of much of the Muslim faith. Nothing of theirs was lacking, small or great, sons or daughters. David recovered it all. So she also, in having to flee had to live with another wife, with David, and they were not always in a comfortable situation. But you will find in 2 Samuel chapter 2 and the first three verses, just a minute, if I get this straight. Oh, I was in the wrong chapter. I wondered why it didn't look right. 2 Samuel chapter 2. Beginning in verse 1, when it happened after this, and the death of Saul being put to death, David inquired of the Lord, saying, "Shall I go up to any of the cities of Judah?" And because he was to be ordained as king. The Lord said, "Go. Where shall I go?" And he said, "To Hebron." So David went up, and his two wives, Ahinoam and Abigail. And David brought up the men who were with him, every man with his household, so they dwelt in Hebron. Then the men of Judah came, and there they anointed David king over the house of Judah. And you will find that ultimately this young lady who left all she had to flee for her life at times, her man became king. So really she had a blessing out of it all, but it didn't seem that way at first. Apparently she respected, and I assume grew to love David because she didn't know him all that well, but she was willing to give up what she had and to have a life with David. And it did involve being, shall we say, the queen of the nation, one of the queens anyway. And you will find in chapter 3, and verse 3, well, let's read the first couple of verses. There was a long war between the house of Saul and the house of David. But David grew stronger and stronger, and the house of Saul weaker and weaker. Sons were born to David in Hebron. The first one was from Amnon by Ahinoam. And his second son was Chileab by Abigail, the widow of Nabal. So she had a son to give to David. Not much is written of Chileab or Chileab. Don't know anything about him, but she did give David a son. So that's kind of the story flow of Abigail in her life, from the wife of a drunkard and an arrogant individual, a harsh and impetuous individual who finally drank himself to death, you might say. But a little bit more about Abigail. She was a very attractive woman. She had very good understanding. David, I said, was about 30 when he was anointed at Hebron over Judah, so I don't know how old she was, but apparently she was a young woman, maybe a very young woman. Nothing is said of Abigail's parents, brothers, sisters. She was kind of like a lone wolf, you might say. No, that's not a good thing to announce. She was a lone one with whom God worked, or through whom God worked. She had knowledge of God's ways. She knew about David being king. Her marriage was not a good one, not a good one at all. She had wealth, but she didn't have a happy union. Still, and this is a key point. She had wealth, but she didn't have a happy union. But she did not allow Nabal to ruin her life. And this is sometimes something that's very hard for a woman to accomplish. She did not allow Nabal to ruin her life. She had a very good relationship with her servant men of the ranch. She was a woman of action. She was able to rule over others quite comfortably. And from reading what we read, she was a woman of very, very powerful, wise words. Very powerful. She also understood men. Sometimes wives say to their husband, "How could you do that?" And we usually don't say, but we should say, "Because I'm a man." She understood men. She allowed them to be men. But she spoke straightforwardly to them, but not with sarcasm or acid. Who knows what would have happened to David had she not intervened? But she did. God worked through this woman in a very, very powerful way. She gave up her home. She gave up her ranch. She gave up her wealth to become the wife of a man destined to be the king, but who at that particular time had to flee from place to place to place to place to keep from being killed by King Saul. So far as I know, nothing else is said of this woman. But she's a very good example of a woman who made the most of a bad marriage because she used her head wisely. She saved a future king from doing some macho thing that he would regret it later on, very much so. And she also appears to be a woman of a positive attitude about herself, which sometimes is rare. And at the same time, she showed deference to men. She led them, but she showed deference to them in a feminine way when it was necessary. And it also appears that there was a strong awareness of God and His ways. After reading the story, to me, Abigail is one of those, if you go out in the evening dark, and you look up and you see the stars and you see them racing across the heavens. To me, Abigail's one of those brilliant stars that race across the sky in a very, very short moment of time. She came, she performed, disappeared. You didn't hear much more about it afterward. But she left a very pleasant memory in the minds of those who were involved. I think, after reading Abigail, we all have our own opinion of who's the very great one, but I think Abigail is a very powerful example for Christian women today as to how to be a woman, to deal with men, and to succeed, and to be in God's family.